Okay. Is everybody happy?
No.
Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter Murray, and I'm here in the Private Eye offices, joined by Adam McQueen, Helen Lewis, and Ian Hislop. We are here to cover the horrible gap that exists for Private Eye subscribers in between issues of the magazine, and we're here to fill it with whatever's been going on since the last issue came out. So, one thing that actually, now this has been in the mag a fair bit, but Adam, you've been reading a lot about this, I know, is the COVID inquiry, which, if you've been following it haphazardly, as I'm sure many of us have, seems to be principally about people reading out rude WhatsApp messages to Dominic Cummings that he wrote.
Having watched Dominic Cummings give his evidence last week, I turned eagerly to the pages of my favourite daily newspapers the next day to see what fun they'd had with him. And it turned out a lot of people didn't think that important at all. No. The Sun, a little bit on page two, the graveyard slot, Dom, the morons of COVID, a couple of other little box outs, that was it. Didn't really bother with all the rest of it. This naturally has nothing to do with the fact that James Slack is deputy editor of The Sun now, but was, at that point, Downing Street, I think, director of communications, was he? Something really, really high up. And although he hasn't given evidence yet, he was not one of the people to stand up at the inquiry last week. We have read lots and lots of WhatsApps, slightly less sweary ones from him. The Mail as well went quite big on it, but with a curious spin, which they shared with The Express, which appeared to be that Dominic Cummings, who'd given evidence, was actually the very, very critical of Boris Johnson. It was actually the other way around. It was Dominic Cummings who was made to look appalling by the riposts from Boris Johnson, which they kind of went big with on their front page. Now Cummings feels the heat, the Daily Mail went with. Well, the Express went with the orgy of narcissism revealed at heart of COVID failings, which, to go with some of the written evidence from Boris Johnson as your front page, when you had Dominic Cummings and Lee Kane on the stand the day before ranting about him for quite a while, is an interesting approach, I think.
But that is genuinely fascinating. One of the things that the COVID inquiry keeps reminding me of is the kind of cosy cabal, and we're going to talk about this later in relation to GB News too, of right-wing media and politics. You know, that was a media government, that Boris Johnson government. Dominic Cummings' wife is deputy editor of The Spectator. Boris Johnson himself, a Mail columnist. The Telegraph is filled with people who are in that government. The Sun is too. It's just entirely impossible to unpick the beef levels because so many people are settling scores with people who have now moved on from politics into journalism and vice versa.
People shouldn't be allowed to move from working in Downing Street to a job on a newspaper where supposedly, you know, they're holding the government to account. Should they? Why has this suddenly become... Why, and I've ranted about this before on this podcast, but why are Alistair Campbell and Ed Balls now allowed to present breakfast TV news programmes? Why is James Slack allowed to be deputy editor of The Sun? It's just weird. I'm
afraid we can't answer any of those questions now.
But we can hand you over to our new star columnist, Liz Truss, who's joining The Eye this week. What is it about? I'm sorry.
It's two different approaches to journalism, isn't it? It's journalism as the continuation of politics by other means versus journalism as the pursuit of truth, however like wanky that sounds. And they're just two completely fundamentally different approaches.
There were certain newspapers who said, we'll cover the content, and the content is entirely, we should never have locked down at all.
Yeah.
Which I don't think was the evidence given, was it?
It's the evidence that's been given in the Telegraph for many, many months now. Some much of it questionable and much of it the resulting in several complaints to Ipso, the press watchdog, and slightly embarrassing corrections, which we've chronicled through the Street of Shame pages as well.
Yeah,
but yes, I mean, everyone, the papers as well, are absolutely pushing their own agenda on this. And obviously in the Daily Mail's case, it's to maintain the reputation of their star columnist and the man they've invested an awful lot of money and time into. So in fact, their editorial that day was that the COVID inquiry has become a circus, and it's very much kind of like, why are we wasting our time and money looking into all of this nonsense? It was all years ago, and like they were with the parties as well. It's, you know, it's all in the past. And at the same time, serialising the works of Nadine Dorries, which I see tomorrow as we speak, are going to tell us all about the downfall of Ian Duncan Smith, which was a mere 20 years ago. So.
The thing that mostly came out of the evidence from last week in the COVID inquiry was the fact that, as you say, there was an initial reluctance to lockdown within Downing Street, and then what happened was they saw, the same way that we did, those pictures from Italy of people kind of just dying in corridors without enough ventilators. And at that point, there seems to have been a certain level of panic kicked in. There's also the fact that people were taking themselves the decision to lock down. If you walked through London in those weeks of March, people were not going into the office, people were not going out to pubs. So there was obviously something needed to be done. I am in the very odd position of having come out with my opinion of Dominic Cummings raised by last week, which was a new and troubling forum. But it did seem to me that for all his many, many flaws, he did try and instill something like a kind of evidence-based process for making decisions. Whereas what the portrait of Boris Johnson that emerges is of someone who disagrees with the last person who spoke to him. And so everything, it turns into a court with the courtiers jostling for power near the king, because if you need, which is exactly what happened with the Trump administration too, right? Everyone just fought to be the last person he'd spoke to because that's who he listened to.
Mm. Well, one of the bits of evidence that that Cummings gave was that actually those famous five Cobra meetings that Boris Johnson missed in the early days, Cummings didn't want him there. He just wanted to keep him out of the way so he could listen to the scientists, didn't he?
Well, the whole thing is a portrait of people basically desperately trying to keep him from doing any harm. So they would digest the kind of, you know, the briefings into WhatsApps for him, because that was all that he could sort of bear to take notice of. And yeah, it's people kind of managing the prime minister.
I have to say that I thought the gossip is incredibly revealing, as it often is. I mean, this is why professional gossip and political gossip is interesting, because it shows you why people make decisions and what they are focused on. And they were focused entirely on protecting their own reputations and slagging off each other. The wider issues seem to have occurred to almost no one at all. The idea that Boris Johnson literally said, you know, this is nature's way of getting rid of old people, that should be enough in any country, in any political climate, for you never to work again and certainly never show your face in public again. Somehow, he's still there.
And also, the other thing I think is really fascinating is I think this is a unique moment in British politics, which is that we have all of this stuff that it would look like private chats that was from the WhatsApps. And I don't, Evan has now learned the lesson that you can switch on disappearing messages and in 24 hours they're gone. And actually, the Scottish politicians, being slightly more savvy on this, have already done that, right? Yes, it's only the sort of the boomers of our, like Whitehall in London, that haven't got that lesson. So we will probably never get quite this kind of insight into a very dysfunctional operation full of, as you say, people fighting each other as much as fighting the coronavirus. The level of disrespect that Dominic Cummings has for anybody who isn't Dominic Cummings, an occasional brilliant woman that he mentions. Every so often a brilliant woman wanders into view.
And then one particular one?
No, it's just always a different one every time. Right, but he's always like, the thing is, women, they're brilliant. Say what you like about women, I've met some brilliant ones. But Helen McNamara, who was deputy head of the Cabinet Office, had to write to Simon Stevens, head of the NHS, and say, you are not taking into account the fact that the protective equipment doesn't fit women's faces and women make up the majority of the NHS workforce. They had all these discussions about football and they didn't have discussions about, I know, you probably know people who gave birth during COVID, either alone or with everybody in masks. These terrifying experiences. But just because the decision makers weren't in the room, those kind of things didn't get considered.
He was mostly talking about pubs, wasn't it? Pubs, yeah, and football.
Pubs, football.
And hunting.
Hunting.
Shooting, yeah, as well, wasn't it?
Hunting
was the big one.
Yeah, that had to keep going.
Well, I remember being in that Sarah Everard vigil, which, as you imagine, was very female-dominated, incredibly aggressively policed. And they had, earlier that day, but the police had been letting off football fans who were rampaging round. And it was that classic police thing of like, oh, no, but those people might actually fight us, so we'll let them do what they want. You women are all just standing here chanting, so, you know, let's like crack a few heads.
That does seem to be the rules at the moment. If it's a very large demonstration, we'll arrest no one. If it's smallish and lots of women, all right then.
What's coming up next? Because I know that Boris is going to give evidence at some point.
Not till December. Right. Although apparently we learned yesterday at dictation speed from Tim Shipman in the Sunday Times that that he's spent this week, when he wasn't in Jerusalem, sequestered with his lawyers, talking over what his response will be to all of these points.
We're never getting that Shakespeare book, are we?
Oh, that ain't never happening. And they're never getting their advance back either, I can guarantee you that.
Do his lawyers still include Lord Panic, who wrote a very thoughtful letter to the paper saying international law does not apply to Israel? Did you see that one?
I didn't see that
one. I thought, no wonder you were such an asset during the hearings to your client when he was found utterly guilty on all... Oh, or was he? Or did he resign first? No, he was found utterly guilty on all fronts of lying to the committee.
I wonder also if they're going to include Jonathan Sumption, the other lawyer who popped up also in the Sunday Times yesterday, doing something I have never seen a lawyer do before, complain that the inquiry was useless because it was over-lawyered and costing too much. What is going... If lawyers start complaining about too many lawyers being paid too much, then where are we going to end up?
That is one of the signs of the apocalypse, isn't it?
Okay, as we've just mentioned, signs of the apocalypse, we should talk about one of the other organisations that believes that the end of the world either is or isn't nigh, and which, Helen, you've been investigating a little bit firsthand. You've been out and about.
Yes, I've been. I was out doing a journalism last week for The Atlantic. I went to the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship Conference, ARC, as it's known, which had a kind of, we are not all doomsterists and denialists, and then had quite a lot of people kind of ringing their bells and saying the end was nigh. The people behind it include Philippa Stroud, who was a political advisor to Ian Duncan Smith, Jordan Peterson, from such tweets as Up Yours, Woke Moralists, and then Paul Marshall, who I think is becoming the most interesting person in British political life. He has kind of become sort of Rupert Murdoch's level of influence without hardly any of the pushback or public profile, I think. So he already has a stake in GB News. He's considering a bid for The Telegraph, maybe even The Spectator. He employs this incredible roster that is made up of conservative politicians, kind of culture warriors. And so the conference was this really bizarre blend of basically earnest Christians and people sort of thundering about Bitcoin and, and Greta Thunberg and, you know, and annoying students. And it summed up to me like where I think the kind of cleavage in modern conservatism is, like, it doesn't quite know what it wants to be. You know, does it like capitalism or not? Does it, you know, is it at ease with the modern world or not?
I think the conference, well, you've mentioned the conference, featured a little bit of climate stuff. I mean, there was a fair bit of denialism about it as well. But it's an interesting message because on the one hand, they are saying the world is definitely not ending due to climate change. That's all fine. But it does seem to have a bit of a millenarian tendency. Is the world ending because of woke people? Is that the
They are message? Everywhere, creeping right. through the streets. Yeah, there is quite a bit of... Because it sells so well on the internet, right? This is the problem that modern conservatism has, is that there are loads of people with very good principled ideas about the world, but there's also a lot of batshit stuff that people really like want to watch on YouTube. And the kind of the siren call of that is always, you know, throbbing out to people, basically.
It's clickbait conservatism, isn't
That's
it?
Very good. Yeah. I might go and amend my article to write it in.
Yeah, you can have that.
As I've coined that now. But yeah, exactly. So Paul Marshall is a really good example of this. So he is, you know, he's a hedge fund manager. He gave a very good speech saying we need a new Teddy Roosevelt, right? Capitalism has delivered prosperity to people, but it's also prone to cronyism. And it's also, you know, markets need to be well regulated. And I was like, I agree with you. I agree with all of this. But then GB News, I switch it on and it's mad people going, Merry Wokemas! Well, how do these two things match up?
What does he want? And how can he be stopped? No, not how can he be stopped. You know, he's a very successful businessman and that's wonderful for him. But, I mean, he's a former Lib Dem, isn't he?
So, yes, he was like one of the Orange Bookers, yeah. So he was always one in the kind of more centrist, kind of pro-capitalist bit of the party. And so, he set up ARC, which is a children's charity. He's also leads up ARC Schools, which runs very well-regarded schools in really tough areas. Like, he's not a kind of mad frother by any means. He's a genuinely serious business person with a proper track record. A couple of things I think happened is Brexit drove him away from the Lib Dems. He was pro-Brexit.
Right.
And I think that's when he parted from them, as they, to be fair, went off on their, like, rejoin campaign. And also his son, Winston, used to be a Mumford & Sons, where he played the banjo, and he was basically forced out. He was a victim of a cancellation. He'd said he liked a book by an American provocateur about Antifa, you know, the very far-leftist protesters. Mm. And for this, he was kind of expelled from the band. And I think that experience of quote-unquote cancellation really turbocharged some of the criticisms that that Paul Marshall had about the kind of the progressive, modern, identity-based left.
Mm.
Has he not been denounced on his own channel? Surely by now, Paul Woke Marshall with his pathetic, softy centre views about not letting the free market run rampage. I think he should be no-platformed.
That's true. I'll mention it to Nigel Farage next time we catch up. That the
or John Cleese, or one of the big heavyweight philosophers on the station.
I do find that very interesting, that obviously nutters pay or earn your channel a lot more than you'll get from reasonable critiques of capitalism. Yeah. I would probably watch the Reasonable Critiques of Capitalism
channel.
Were
there more people at the conference you attended than watched GB News over any hour?
Oh, that's very cruel.
there were 1,500 delegates, and some of them had paid up to £1,500. There were reduced tickets at £300 as well. Some people were invited. So there was, you know, there's a serious caucus for this kind of stuff.
If he's a proper businessman, he should just be doing events. Just forget the channel. Do us all a favour.
Well, you know, I sent Adam a picture of the canapes because the canapes were great. So, you know.
The canapes did look good. You see, I'm a proper journalist. This is why. Was there free booze and what were the canapes like?
Thank God someone's doing journalism properly.
How much did you pay, Helen? Which tranche were you in?
Oh, please know that I was comped my ticket because I'd like to put through the expenses of £1,500 to go into a conservatism conference.
What did you get for the £1,500 tickets then? Is it like meet and greet with
They had dinners in the evenings, hosted by people. So they had people like, listed on the thing was Candace Owens, who's a very provocative US person. Yeah, Winston Marshall did one of the dinners.
Did he play?
The banjo. I don't know, they didn't invite That's where all the real kooky stuff happens at those Conservative conferences. If you remember at NatCon, National Conservatism Conference, it was the dinner at the private invitation-only dinner that Douglas Murray decided to make his speech about how the... Do you remember this? About how the Germans had, quotes, got carried away twice during the 20th century. So that's where the real spicy opinions come out post-dinner.
Was there an option for paying £1,500 not to have dinner with Candice Owens and the banjo player from Mumford & Sons? Because that's the one I definitely have gone for.
It was an amazingly well put together conference. They had a band playing like Fanfare for the Common Man and stuff like that. And they'd flown over people from Duck Dynasty, which is a US reality TV show that is wildly popular in America. Not a soul had heard of it here.
Another Donald Dynasty that doesn't work very well?
Well, that is the kind of weird element to it. So I think a lot of people who just read the news in Britain is that it's very American, this stuff. It's very... I mean, the NatCon was highly American, and recently Suella Braverman talking about how we can't have our cities turning into places like San Francisco. Most British people will think, what do you mean like San Francisco? With trams? What do you mean? What are you talking about? Yeah. There is a kind of transatlantic understanding about this, which I think escapes a lot of people here.
It's where a lot of the money is. And this had lots of Australians and Canadians too. So there is a kind of Anglo alliance of conservatism that's built itself up. And actually, NatCon is organised by an Israeli guy who heads something called the Edmund Burke Foundation, which isn't very much in tune with what Edmund Burke thought, but we'll leave that aside for another time. You know, I think there's always a sense in British politics, particularly the generation that grew up on the West Wing, that American politics is real politics. It's big and like, and cannons go off and confetti.
There are caucuses.
Things happen in New Hampshire. And so there's a kind of great joy about it. But the problem is that the British speakers, the American speakers, Canadian speakers, were often quite reasonable people with governing records. So like John Howard, who was Prime Minister of Australia. And then who'd you get in from America? It's always some crank. So in this case, it was Dr. Oz, who used to be on Oprah and then ran for the Senate last time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and Vivek Ramaswamy, who basically is like a podcast made flesh, which I shouldn't say on a podcast, but he is basically the living embodiment of the concept of podcasts. And America just doesn't have a centre-right. It has anti-wokeness. That's it.
Is it inevitable that the two Paul Marshalls you saw there, that... he will end up going for the woke pound because that's where there's more money.
Yeah, it is a bit kind of the arc of conservatism is long, but it bends towards people complaining about Greta Thunberg and pronouns. That is kind of how I felt about it all, which I think would be a shame because, as I say, I think he's a much more serious person and thinker than you would get from what's produced. And, you know, and I think Unheard, which he also has a stake in, has that duality in it too. Some of the stuff on there is really good. Some of the stuff on lockdown is crank. It is kind of which way Western man, basically. Like, which of these is going to win will shape British politics, I think, over the next 10 years.
We should turn... Actually, this is sort of... this next thing that I was hoping we could talk about kind of dovetails together everything we have been so far, because we've got people being a bit mad about COVID, people being combinations of politicians and journalists, and it's our great friend of this podcast, actually, Nadine Dorries, because, yes, her book, The Plot... The Political Assassination of Boris Johnson, is out shortly, and it's currently being serialised in the Mail and the Mail on Sunday. And it's full of absolutely eye-popping allegations, which, if true, are really extraordinary. I mean, but...
That's the biggest if I've ever heard on any podcast ever. I'm amazed you had the gall to even say
which
it.
Which, if... really huge, important if true is the sign. Who said that there should be a sign over every church in the land saying important if true? Which is a great, you know... And the same thing applies to the other good book that we're about to get a sight of, which is The Plot. Because there are all these allegations in it. Some of them are massive and stacked up. I mean, the most serious one is about the allegation that the Conservative Party covered up allegations that a Conservative MP had raped five women or committed five rapes, and there is some party documentation to back that up. But the allegations are so huge and scattergun, and they form a kind of corkboard wall with bits of string tying absolutely everything together and leading to one answer, which is Boris Johnson is a great man, he was stitched up, he didn't know anything, he's also very wise somehow. And the book is Really, a kind of pro-Boris book.
I'm not sure I'd go as far as tied together. I mean, I've only read the serialisation in the Daily Mail, which presumably has had a sort of extra level of editing on it, but it still seemed pretty stream of consciousness. It's kind of up there with Finnegan's Wake. Today was there was never any gold wallpaper, and there were never any parties, which did seem to be. I mean, that's quite a lot of evidence and quite a lot of inquiries to say that there weren't.
Well, this is the week in which a woman has said there was not one day, not one day in which the COVID rules were actually obeyed.
And Lulu Little said, well, it wasn't gold, it was yellow. I mean, that was the person who sold them
the
wallpaper.
Says it was red, so immediately we've got quite a
so that apparently, classic Boris, that so what seems to have happened is they bought the wallpaper, they put the wallpaper up, and they decided they didn't like it, so they repainted at a cost to taxpayers of £7,500 the wall red after that, in moving tribute to the red wall.
Or was it like a feature wall? Because that's the red wall that you've heard so much about.
Yeah. Okay. But yeah, I sort of strongly object to this book because I just felt, I mean, I felt like it's so hard to keep a track of what's true when people are just straightforwardly lying about things that you remember happening. That's the very odd thing about it. Is like the wallpaper being a very classic example or the parties. You're like, but you do have this moment where you go, am I wrong? Where did I read that? Is that true? And then it sort of reasserts itself that, no, I did. That is true.
Well, the parties is another really good example. So the book is, again, lots of it is dictated. It's quoting Boris directly. I mean, he's the chief source for it. Her contention is that Boris knew nothing about any of the illegal parties, i.e. the really enormous ones, which featured karaoke machines and suitcases of wine. And she believes that there was a culture of that at Downing Street. Boris really knew nothing about any of this. He'd always gone home on a Friday night. You know, he'd always gone back to his constituency. And it does take a little bit of mental effort to remember, no, hang on, there are lots of people who've said, I mean, Helen McNamara, again, last week at the COVID inquiry, saying there wasn't one day in which the rules were observed. Mm. And then Doris goes on to quote Boris saying that he was thanking people and raising morale. Again, that's still his version of events, but actually, the whole point is that there was no format in which you could have an after-work event. Whether you're thanking people, raising morale, saying happy birthday, it doesn't matter. That wasn't legal. There was not a carve-out in the law to have work.
No, and we listened to all this evidence in the inquiry, which was overwhelming, and his attempts to portray his own story were dismantled forensically by the people in charge of doing that. Such to the point where he knew the game was up and ran away before he could actually be thrown out. Another great act of personal bravery, similar really to visiting Israel, I think, at this particular time. Boris goes and really helps things out in the Middle East.
Yeah.
I miss him.
As you say, this has been legislated over and over and over. We've had all the evidence of this so many times. But now we've basically got the equivalent of just a sort of three-year-old putting their fingers in the wrist and going, no, it wasn't, no, it wasn't, no, it wasn't, la, 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 la. That's what this book appears to be.
Well, I see then, Adam, you don't believe in the movement.
The movement.
We should talk about the movement.
This is behind my newfound love of Dominic Cummings, because the Mail on Sunday kept sending him comment requests about it, and he kept sending back sarcastic WhatsApp that said, you've got me.
Yeah.
The Dean has uncovered the plot. I'm taking all my orders from MI6 and the CIA.
And the KGB.
Please print this in full.
So we should say what the movement is. The movement. And again, I find it quite hard, because I'm a big fan of Mission Impossible, and the last three films have featured the Syndicate, the Apostles, and the Entity, and I'm just completely muddled as to which was made up by Nadine Dorries, and which
I thought one of those were team names on The Apprentice.
Well, this is a cabal of very powerful unelected men who, for more than 20 years, have been directing the country, subtly, shaping things, occasionally offing prime ministers. They've been, you know, they got rid of Ian Duncan Smith. I know.
Is this the 1922 committee?
No, it's. But it is what that is. What it boils down to essentially is the Tory Party are a bit vicious and they get rid of leaders when they think they've served their time. Well, we've known that since at least November 1990, haven't we?
Michael Gove exists, uncovers like Nadine Dorries.
This is the kind of thing. It's sort of. It sort of reflects reality, but these allegations take it much further than that and say that it is a coherent block, which is not. It's people, you know, out for their own careers and trying to screw each other over and trying to make sure they survive. You know, that's
or politicians, as we usually call them. Yes,
the removal of Ian Duncan Smith was what, a tragedy, a good thing,
a tragedy. Nadine is very pro IDS.
I thought they got rid of him because he couldn't win the election.
Well, you've been taken in by the movement, I'm afraid, Ian. That's it.
What I really love is the fact that obviously the Mail employs lots of people who have direct knowledge of these events who have got to sort of like go la 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 la. So Amanda Patel was his press secretary, IDS's press secretary. Yeah. Presumably she's got strong views on it, but like no.
Well, the wonderful thing about it being serialised in the Mail is that you know with the Mail they don't mind blue on blue attacks. So Sarah Vine, Michael Gove's ex-wife, yesterday, did you see that?
Nope.
You quoted the Queen, recollections may vary, which I thought was quite neat.
Ice cold. I also love that. I'm in favour of that.
But no, the movement did everything. They incubated Rishi Sunak. They were preparing him, but when Boris won the election...
Preparing him? For what?
And then apparently when Boris won in 2019, you know, the movement were happy, but also they were a bit annoyed because he'd won too big. He'd won an 80-seat majority, and that wasn't what they'd planned. It's again, it's really classic conspiracist stuff, is that everything is within someone's control. And in this case, it's four people who seem to be the core of the movement.
Yes, it's Dougie Smith, who is a longtime Downing Street aide, who's the husband of Munira Mirza, who did a lot more of the kind of culture war-y sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Is in the movement. Michael Gove is in the movement, yep. I think. Dominic Cummings is in the movement.
Yep.
Sue Gray was briefly in the movement, but has fallen out with him and is now a mole inside Labour,
brilliant,
according to Nadine. There is no end to the movement's tentacles.
No.
Am I alone in thinking it's not a publisher you need, it's a therapist?
The strange thing about it is that there's an odd mixture of stuff that you go, is that really a big deal? That sounds unlikely. And didn't we know this at the time? So one of the things that she reveals is that David Cameron didn't want Dominic Cummings to go and work for Michael Gove. And now I sort of, you know, having been around for long enough, I remember that happening. And so it's not sort of news to me.
No, it was public that Cameron described him as a career psychopath. When that was all on the record.
I know, one of the better David Cameron Burns, to be honest. But then there's also stuff that I just don't believe, like the bit where Dominic Cummings apparently wanted to make the Downing Street speech.
After the 2019 election.
Yeah. The thing yeah. Say what you will about
but isn't
Dominic
that evidently
Cummings.
A joke? Isn't that him saying, well, I could give the speech for you. Yeah. Boom, boom.
Yeah, how hard can it be? Even I could do it. Right, whereas we all know that his preferred format is the 30,000-word blog post. Like, it's just, it's very strange.
We'd still be there. He'd still be the Lexan, telling us about Sun Tzu's The Art of War.
But and now what von Neumann would have to say about Brexit. Oh, spare us.
There is a kind of ability to see half the story, I think, in lots of the book. So, I mean, lots of it, and certainly lots of the more juicy extracts that have been published, are about a culture of sexual license in Downing Street and at the top of the Conservative Party. I mean, lots and lots of recent court cases.
Which suggests that's
whip,
true. Yeah.
Which suggests that's true. What happened in the last 3 years? Who was Prime Minister for the last 3 years? Who might have contributed to that culture? Boris Johnson. But that doesn't quite fit the picture, so it's not allowed in even slightly.
Yes.
You know, and it's really hedged around by saying, well, Boris is a much married man, or Boris has certainly made his mistakes. But, and then it moves on to a much more...
Well, Chris Pincher's alleged sexual assault for which he lost the whip is reduced to grabbing some guy's arse in a club.
Yeah.
And that's the really strange thing, is that there's a kind of Schrodinger's sexual assault. When it's people, you know, that you don't like, then it's really serious and we should talk about it. And when it's people that you do like, then, it's no big deal. Like, you know... Yeah. Who can really say what happened?
I'm sorry to lower the tone. There is an account in the Dorries extracts of the fact that whips know about someone receiving oral sex who's not his wife, and the whips having a video of this. Now, there was a story last year in a really disreputable magazine, can't remember which one, about someone receiving oral sex in the office and someone walking in on them with someone who wasn't his wife, and that was Boris Johnson.
Yes.
And Carrie. Again.
Are you in favour of it or against it, Andy? Pick one.
I'm asking Nadine whether she's in favour of it or against it. As in, I'd like to know whether that's acceptable or not.
But this is her entire world view. If you remember when she initially complained about the previous Tory administration, it's because Cameron and Osborne were posh boys.
Yeah.
Unlike Boris.
Right.
Who's not a posh boy. I mean, admittedly, Osborne didn't go to Eton, which is a big failing among certain people. Yes, I mean... well-known Oiki Osborne. But she cannot hold two ideas in her head at the same time. And you see that over notions of poshness, notions of harassment, notions of truth, which is why the only thing in the book I don't believe, and I will not believe, is that she was culture secretary. Strikes me as complete rubbish.
Show us the evidence.
Anyway, if you're in the movement and you'd like to set the record straight on this, phone in to the next recording of Page 94 and we'll do our best to get you heard if we've got time.
And we will pick a suitable James Bond-style pseudonym for you.
Yes.
Which she doesn't even manage to be consistent. On those, we've got Dr. No, we've got Moneypenny, and we've got Skyfall. That was a house. That wasn't even a person. Come on, you've got all of those villains to choose from.
I know, what's wrong with Scaramanga? I hope there's a secret Scaramanga in there.
Helen, Adam, and Ian there. Now, we turn to one of the other stories which we were gearing up to in the last issue of the magazine, all about the AI summit, the two-day summit at Bletchley Park, hosted by Rishi Sunak and, in a bigger sense, Britain itself. All about AI, its development, its potential risks, its potential opportunities, which culminated, as you may have seen, in Rishi Sunak interviewing Elon Musk live on stage. The Eye's tech correspondent Matt Muir watched the conference and has been covering it for the next issue of The Eye, but we have an early preview of it with him now. I started off by asking Matt, firstly, what the aims of the conference overall actually were, and secondly, whether those aims were met. Here's Matt.
There are multiple potential ways that you could interpret the aims of the summit. Those that were announced by or summarised by Ian Hogarth, who is one of the people who effectively advises the government, who runs their AI task force, basically, he suggested that in advance of the summit, what they wanted to do was effectively build international consensus around the fact that, you know, this stuff is important and maybe a bit scary. Secondly, create some sort of momentum for a continued discussion of AI and related safety issues at an international level in the future, that there was going to be some sort of solidification of evidence base and the ability for countries to have more ability to effectively work out the dangerousness or otherwise of future models. And to a certain extent, you know, those have been achieved to a certain degree. I mean, I think it's fair to say that the eyes of the world were on Bletchley, which certainly for the Prime Minister was very much a box ticked. And it is true that multiple nations around the world, including China, the US and various EU countries, did sign this Bletchley Park Declaration last week. And, you know, there is a commitment that there are going to be further safety summits in Korea and in France. And Rishi did get his moment in the spotlight with a global AI leader in the shape of Mr. Musk. So to that extent, I suppose you could argue that, you know, the boxes were ticked. On the other hand, one might also look at some of the detail and kind of look, well, there's not actually that much there, is there? I mean, the declaration was lovely, but it frankly amounts to not a huge degree more than a bunch of countries coming together and go, well, you know what, this stuff could be a little bit frightening in the future. We probably ought to think about this some more, which, you know, is good, but doesn't necessarily move the needle in any particular way. I mean, you know what? Broadly speaking, it was a nice few days for the Prime Minister. It was a nice few days for the UK's AI initiative. It was slightly perhaps overshadowed by the executive order coming out of the US that President Biden signed off coincidentally on the first day of the summit, maybe to steal some of the thunder. And of course, the various noises coming out of both the EU and the G7 in terms of more practical commitments. But you know what? Nothing terrible happened. So on that basis alone, I suppose we can vaguely feel reassured that we haven't come any closer to the feared AI apocalypse than maybe we were a week ago.
It's really interesting what you say about the bigger companies announcing that they're going to let governments have some oversight, because that seems crucial. And obviously, although this is a first step, and you know, this is not the sort of final state of affairs, but then again, the technology is moving very fast. Is there anything to stop other companies from launching their own large models without consulting governments, or for them to do it outside the remit of these governments? Because you're dealing with national governments and global technology. Doesn't that pose a problem?
Short answer, yes. One of the interesting schisms in the wider world of AI that was highlighted somewhat by the past week's events is effectively the dichotomy between those companies that believe that the technology should be fully open sourced, that is, that models, when created, should be effectively made available to anybody who wants to use them, unfettered, because that is the way that, you know, communities coalesce around technology, make them safer, make them better, and can improve them faster. Versus, on the other hand, companies that, for various reasons, believe that to make them open source would be a terrible idea. And that by putting these technologies potentially into the hands of anybody who might want to use them, who might want to tweak them, manipulate them, and go to town with their usage in a way that is completely unfettered by, you know, international consensus, is maybe not a good idea. So to your question, The eight companies that have signed up to this declaration that they are going to let governments test their things, brilliant, but they are not the only eight companies working on this, obviously. Again, as with these technologies, broadly speaking, it is a step in the right direction that we are getting to a point where governments can be involved in potentially testing these technologies. But given the fact that we don't know what safe looks like, that we don't have an oversight as to what all of these technologies are and who is developing them and where, and indeed any guarantee that governments will be given the potential to test all of them, it does feel a little bit like it's maybe not the overwhelming success story that it was potentially painted as by number 10.
One thing that was really interesting sort of follow-up story was Oliver Dowden, the Deputy Prime Minister, saying that already there are decisions being made, that the government is already starting to experiment with folding AI into decision-making in terms of gathering together bits of information, you know, supposedly lead to more rigorous decision-making, which also saves time. Was there any discussion of that at the conference, or whether there might be a bit of an accountability gap here?
Interestingly, there was no discussion of that whatsoever. That was obviously a nice exclusive given to the Sunday Times, Carolyn Wheeler, the political editor, being the journalist who wrote that up. There was an interesting broader trend here last week. The move of this story and AI as a concept from the technology pages and the science pages to the political pages means that the people who are reporting on this and who are maybe asking questions of government are not necessarily perhaps as au fait with some of the fundamental questions around the use of this technology as they might potentially wish to be, which means that you get odd situations like the Deputy Prime Minister announcing to the Sunday Times that blithely that we are embracing artificial intelligence to ease our workload by trialing AI red boxes, but no mention in the article of, okay, so what model are you using? What was it trained on? What work has been done to ensure the elimination of bias? What work has been done to minimize the potential for hallucination? And indeed, no question as to the extent to which it is a good thing that rather than a bunch of, I don't know, supposedly qualified and intelligent elected cabinet ministers being given information to read, digest, and then using their own personal experience and the qualities which are supposedly those which have led them to be elected in the first place, that they won't use those qualities. Instead, they'll just let the machine do all the analysis and decide what the proper course of action should be. I mean, it does sort of make you wonder, rather than civil servants potentially losing their jobs, what's the point of the MP in this?
One of the other things that was kind of a feature, but again, very briefly, is the risk of AI when it comes to disinformation and a kind of collapse in verifiable sources, verifiable images, this kind of thing, which we're already starting to see online, or very skillfully deepfaked images, videos, audio recordings, you know, all of these things. What was the timbre of the discussion about that at the conference?
Again, you may be surprised to learn that there was relatively little time devoted to that particular question, or rather, one of the sort of eight plenary sessions within the Bletchley Park Summit was specifically devoted to issues around misinformation. But it's important to remember that the summit was focused on issues of what are termed frontier AI, which is, frankly, all of the apocalyptic world-ending stuff that might happen at some point in the future, rather than the more knotty, thorny questions of all of the ways in which it is changing our civilization and society, potentially for the worse, right now. I think it's actually important, given you mentioned disinformation, just to highlight the fact that we're still not in a situation now where AI created deepfake video or deepfake audio is a massive problem. There isn't loads of it about. And what there is of it about often is still not perfect enough to fool anyone. What it is doing, though, is increasingly making people skeptical about what they see and making people doubt sources, specifically video and audio sources. And think of it more as a sullying of the information water table rather than something that's prevalent everywhere already. And yeah, answers to how to deal with that, there came none from the summit.
That's very, how can I put it, depressing and slightly unsurprising to hear. I guess we should move on to the big ticket item, which is, of course, the fact that Rishi Sunak got to practice his interviewing skills on the world's wealthiest man, Elon Musk, who's obviously one of the leaders in this space and is has since made his own rather big announcement about AI.
Yes, I thought what was interesting was the slightly sniffy reaction it got from lots of people suggesting that the roles should have somehow been reversed, that Musk should somehow have been grateful to have been in the presence of Rishi Sunak rather than Sunak's very obvious gratitude to have been in the presence of Elon Musk, which I think possibly maybe misrepresents Britain's importance on the international stage. much as it pains me to have to admit it, Elon Musk has, whatever you might think of the man, made not insignificant contributions to technology over the course of the past 2 decades. It seems unlikely that we're going to be able to say much the same about Rishi Sunak when he finally shuffles out of number 10 in what we predict to be somewhere short of 18 months' time. But to go to the meat of their conversation, I mean, frankly, Elon Musk said very, very little that he hadn't said previously. It was less than revelatory in terms of the meat of the conversation. I mean, the fact that he believes that one day there won't be any jobs for people to do is not a surprise to anybody who's been paying attention either to him or, frankly, to the development of AI and its likely progression over the course of the past 12 months.
I believe that Elon Musk announced his own model, or the launch of his own kind of X language model AI system. Is this going to be one of the ones which is given to governments for a bit of oversight and regulation or not?
Well, interestingly, X was not one of the companies that signed up to the safety commitments that make of that what you will. This isn't a surprise. This is something that he announced, I think it might have been 4 or 5 months ago, if listeners will doubtless again recall, hanging as they do on Musk's every pronouncement, that he expressed one or two fears about the fact that ChatGPT might be a bit woke, and so therefore expressed a desire to build an unwoke AI. And as a result of this, on Saturday the 4th of November, X announced that it was launching Grok, a genuinely horrible name taken from a science fiction novel by Robert Heinlein called Stranger in a Strange Land. The word is basically, in common parlance, it means to, you know, deeply understand something. A very, very nerdy term. So early reports are, according to Elon Musk, is that it's sarcastic and it's funny and it's a bit rebellious and irreverent and kind of cool. I mean, your mileage may vary on your opinion of Elon Musk and what he thinks is cool and how cool or otherwise that might be. But it knows how to swear, and it will swear. And if you ask it to make cocaine or tell you how to make cocaine, it'll tell you jokes before, obviously, they're going on to tell you, no, you really don't want to make cocaine. One of the interesting things about Grok that that Musk is very much trailing, other than the fact that it is very much not going to be woke, he keeps on saying this, is that it has access to real-time information. And the way it does that is because it has access to the fire hose of posts from X. Which is interesting, because Musk has also previously stated that he wants to make his AI the maximally truthful AI. Now, there's an interesting dichotomy there for anybody who's spent any time on X since the Muskian takeover and has possibly noticed that it's a little bit harder to determine whether or not anything that's being said on there is true, whether it's just being said by some random Nazi who decides to pay for verification and spout rubbish. Exactly how having a real-time feed of information from a platform which is no longer a byword for trustworthiness is an interesting one. I thought it was particularly timely, given that Elon has seen fit to readmit both Katie Hopkins and Tommy Robinson to the platform, despite their having been banned for breaking its previous terms and conditions for the past, I think, 5 or 6 years. So, yeah, if you want to know exactly the sort of high-quality, truthful information that Grok, the new XAI, is going to be drawing from to help educate and inform and amuse its users, it's going to be taking stuff from people like Tommy Robinson and Katie Hopkins, which is something I think we can agree we can all look forward to in the future.
Oh dear. Matt, thank you very much. That is an incredibly helpful rundown.
Try not to get too sad and worried.
Good advice from Matt Muir there. But if you feel like you've got the capacity to be a bit sad and worried, why not take out a subscription to Private Eye magazine? It's available in good newsstands, of course, but also you can go to private-eye.co.uk and click on the button marked subscribe and get it delivered to your door at reasonable rates. We'll be back again with another episode of this podcast in a fortnight. So until then, thank you for listening. This episode, as always, was produced by Matt Hill of Rethink Audio. Goodbye.